אחת. So probably not. The country is anti-Semitic, if you assume that unless you know the opposite, that they are. Unless you know they are not. In that sense, America is anti-Semitic, less so than it was. Greatly less, less than it was, curiously enough. It's not quite clear why, but certainly less so. France is, Russia is, Germany is, Austria is, Italy is not. Scandinavia, up to a point. Up to a point. More so than people think. Holland is not. Spain is. Portugal is not. And so on.
All right. Now let's come back to questions of the other meeting. How long, how much
is it? I'll tell you, I probably can go until about, actually about 5 o'clock past.
Yes, I mean, all right, anyway, no more.
Plenty of time, yes.
Hard,
I do, yes.
When you look back, on your friendships with Russian emigres or children of Russian emigrants from in England during the I think you were a child.
Yes.
Can one speak about
Russian Jewish or Russian?
Both. I mean, we should distinguish.
They're quite different.
I know. There are many distinctions, but generally speaking, can one speak about Russian immigration to the emigratia harusit in England now?
No, one cannot. There's no such thing compared to other countries. Paris, yes.
It was less than Paris.
Less than Paris, less than New York.
In numbers? Or
in numbers. The number of non-Jewish Russians, it existed, of course, but there was a kind of, there wasn't. There were Russians in London and elsewhere, and they knew each other. But they were mainly, I don't know how many, but they didn't form a coherent group, as far as I know.
But can one speak
but
about...
But I never knew them.
No.
I didn't know them.
That's the non-Jewish ones.
Non-Jewish ones. The Jews, of course, all crowded to Hampstead. We didn't live there. We live in Kensington, and from time to time, my parents naturally visited and were visited by them. That is, six or seven Russian Jewish families of more or less the same bourgeois origin as my parents. Of course, they exist. I can give you their names, who my parents were on friendly terms. But because my parents didn't play cards, and because my parents weren't very rich and didn't gamble, and because they didn't live in Hampstead, above all, but lived in Kensington, in order to make it possible for me to go to my school on foot, they were somewhat outsiders in that culture. They were known, quite respected, but not felt to be, so to speak, center of that colony, as, for example, Max Beloff's parents were. But I can tell you who they were. I can recite six or seven names. It was family called the Shalits, because they came from Riga, of course, and so my parents knew them from those days. There were the Shalits, there was a man called Zinn, Z-I-N-N, who was a jolly fellow, whose son became a master at Westminster. The pupil of my new college became baptized. There was two sisters, one knew well. Then there was the Beloff family, who of course we knew. There was, I'm just trying to think of names, I've forgotten my name largely. There's a charming man called Rachmilevich, who had a dominant influence on me. I think I've talked about him already. He was even living as the Shalits. But where did one meet them? There was a man called Wolf, William Wolf, who was head of the Jewish Colonial Trust, Zionist Bank. There was a man called Kagan, who was some sort of businessman in London. Nothing to do with President Lord Kagan. Kagan. Not all that many. My parents knew many more than I knew. But what used to happen is there was an annual ball called the Ort Ball of the Ort organization. You know what Ort is? Ort. There was a ball organized by the Berloffs and others, to which the entire Russian Jewish colony turned up. You saw them there en gros, in bulk.
Organized by whom?
The Berloff family.
Why?
Because Mrs. Berloff was a very keen worker for Ort, Max's mother. She was a comparatively educated woman who I think had been to some kind of university in Russia. His father was an extremely tough, amusing, clever, interesting man of rather peasant type. And Simon Berloff. She was one, and then with the others, there was a man called Mofshevich, who was a Jew, Bundist, who also belonged to it, who was secretary to Lucien Wolf. And the major factor, Lucien Wolf's acute anti-Zionism. And that used to, huge ball used to occur, in which all the Russian Jews turned up, and they saw each other, talked to each other. That was a Russian event.
And
I didn't go it every year, but after I was 15 or 16, I was sometimes taken to it. And I used to watch these people, that's all. I didn't know 3/4 of them.
No. Then when you came to Oxford, did you have any friends of Russian descent?
One. Exactly one. Not a Jew. No. That's not quite true. Well, the Shapiro family, I forgot Leonard Shapiro's family, that's Riga too. Not as much as some, but they came to Old Ball. No, I mean, there was a Shield boy in Scotland, and there was an attempt. He certainly was part of it, his father. Who was they here? Who was they here? Nobody, no. No, no. There were only people, the Trillings, as well. Very well, the Russian Jewish family. Trilling. Trilling. Yes. Same as the writer. Well, they came to Bialystok, yes. He was a merchant who had two sons, one of whom still writes about music, some sort of music critic and ballet critic. A brother whom I knew quite well. Why did I know him? Because of these Hempstead connections. He wasn't at school with me. No, only one Russian did I really know, and that was a half-English Russian called Ivan Bilibin. He was at St. Paul's. Once per month I talked Russian to him. He was the son of a very famous Russian painter called Bilibin, who had an English wife, came to London, then went back to the Soviet Union where he died. He did icons, he did ballets, he was a kind of Slavic style painter, greatly respected, very quite famous in the history of Russian painting. The son was very right wing, he's alive, still, my age, and he's one of the courtiers of the pretender to the Russian throne. All his life was spent entirely as a professional monarchist, so to speak, agitator, and so to speak, political activist. Rather eccentric. Him I knew. He was at Oxford and at St. Paul's. He was at school with me, and he came to Oxford in the same year as I did.
And that's it?
That's it.
And among the old aristocratic families, are there?
I knew nobody.
I ask you because I noticed that you formed acquaintanceship and friendship all along your life with many Russians.
Not many, no.
So,
Not Penny. Miss Kalin, she was a typical Russian Jewess, who organized the third program.
What's her name?
Kalin. Nyuta Kalin, Anna Kalin. She was more responsible than anybody for the third program on the wireless. She was a Moscow Jewess.
Moscow Jewess.
And I met her after the war.
After the war? Yes. All right. I mean,
I knew she may have shaken hands with her before the war, but I got to know her after the war.
And after the war, you met me? Or during the war and after the war?
During the war, I must have met some in Washington, but not many.
Now, when did you meet the Pasternaks? I mean, the sisters?
Well, only when they came to live here, which was the beginning of the war.
Beginning of the war?
Yes. Mm-hmm. At least, so when the father was here. Pasternak, the painter, came here. I was then, Katkov was a Russian, of course I knew. He came here in 38. And again in 39.
Did he come to Oxford?
Certainly he came to Oxford. He came to bring the papers, the philosophical papers, of the teacher of his teacher, namely Brentano, who was a famous philosopher in Prague.
That Brentano.
There was a Brentano Institute, founded by Masaryk in Prague. Masaryk was a pupil of Brentano. And Krauss, who was Katkov's master, was a professor who was a direct pupil of Brentano. And Katkov is a pupil of Krauss, who was a philosopher in Prague. He brought the material because of the Nazi dangers, etc., spoke very little English, and I was produced as an interpreter between him and two or three Oxford philosophers. That's how I met him. Then he went back to Prague and he rescued Krauss. He brought to Oxford. Krauss was baptized, but it would not have gone well with him. And Krauss's wife was a famous Diseuse. She recited German poetry in theaters. And they came and lived in Parktown, and three doors away was Pasternak and his two daughters. That's when I met them. During the war, I don't think I saw them, but I saw a certain amount of them after the war. Pasternak died during the war, or at the end of it.
So brought the papers of Krauss or Brentano?
He brought Brentano's archive to Oxford, and then handed it over to Brentano's son or grandson in Northwestern University, somewhere in some kind of scientist in the Middle West, to which they ultimately went. He was more or less a keeper of the Brentano archive.
And then when
Katkov I saw from time to time during the war when he worked, he must have been a monitor. In Evesham, which was where wartime, with Weidenfeld, with Kalin, and a number of other persons. Leonard Shapiro, Madariaga's daughter, they were all monitors.
In different languages?
In different languages. Leonard Shapiro was a Russian monitor.
When a man like Katkov comes to Oxford, did he find any other Russians?
He probably did, but I didn't know them.
Not many.
Very, very few. Certainly no. Hardly anybody. I can't think of who there was. There was no professor before the war. Konovalov, who later became professor, used to come from Birmingham once a week. There was a man called Narishkin, Captain Narishkin of a Boyar family, noble family, but I don't know if Katkov ever knew him. He lived in Boz Hill. He used to give sort of balalaika parties to English undergraduates. I don't know if any Russians here before the war. There was no Russian teaching here, or very little.
Before the war?
Well, there was, but not by the time I came here.
But who were the teachers of, let's say, Max Iwald, Harry Willett, Obolensky?
Oh, up to Dobrinsk with Russian.
Yes, but he studied Russian here.
No.
Yes, I mean,
No. Obolensky was in Cambridge. He was a fellow of Trinity. Obolensky was educated with a Russian beginning. I mean, he was a natural Russian speaker. And Russian was brought up in a wholly Russian atmosphere. Obolensky didn't learn Russian. Never.
I got the wrong impression.
Absolutely. He was a Russian prince who didn't need to learn Russian. His parents spoke Russian to him and all his brothers and sisters. No, the English who learned Russian learned it here after the war. Nobody learned it here before the war. Not really. I mean, Maurice Bauer taught himself Russian. Martin Cooper, my friend who was a Russian musical critic, taught himself. They had no teachers. After the war, there were teachers of Russian.
Russian literature?
What about it? What?
Russian literature?
No. As far as I know, no. Well, the modern languages didn't include Russian. I don't know. As I say, I think Professor Konovalov used to come from Birmingham once a week, so maybe he had some pupils, but it was very, very thin. It existed, but in a very, very marginal way.
Now, you mentioned other names, but I thought that there was more than just by chance that so many Russian names crop up. But you mentioned Alexander Halperin. You mentioned
him. I met in New York.
You met him in New York.
Yes, he was a British agent. He was a British in the intelligence service in New York, and some Zionist with a. I think a man called Historic, who was the head of the Jewish Colonial Bank Trust, whom I must have met, I don't know, the oddball, anyway, who like, introduced us. Thought I might wish to meet him, so I then met him in New York. And I used to go to dinner with him in New York. He had a very interesting Georgian wife, I mean, she was a Georgian princess. And there I did meet some members of the Russian aristocracy. Who lived in New York.
In New York?
Yes, but not very frequently.
He came from England, didn't he?
Came from London. Who, Alban? London.
London. He was in New York.
Yes, because he was sent as a sort of agent to New York. And I used to go to dinner with Bill Deakin. I used to go with him in his office. They worked together, same office. Bill Deakin, Freddie Eyre, used to come to dinner, and I used to be there to put, I talk Russian to him. Naturally, they didn't. He was in London throughout the 20s and 30s, but I had no idea he existed. I tell you, I was remote from the Russian colony. I was no part of it. The fact that I preserved my Russian as well as I have is very peculiar.
That's
very odd, it's true. Very odd. I talked to my parents in English.
That is so my question.
I'm telling you, nobody can explain it. I really talk to Russian perfectly, more or less. Though I say it myself. Sometimes I don't know where to stress certain words, but in Russia it's always the same with me. The question is always the same when I talk Russian. They say, do you come from Moscow? Do you come from Leningrad? Do you come from Odessa? Nobody says. The only person who ever made a remark about my Russian was very funny. Was in 45. I met an American journalist called Scott, who had been a communist, of course, this time, and no longer was married to a Russian girl. We met in Donbass for some of the Don, where he was a factory worker, a keen communist recruit. By this time, he was the correspondent of Time magazine. This is 45. And she said to me, you know, your Russian is very good, quite all right, everything is perfectly good. Something funny about it also. So I said, what is funny? She said, I don't quite know how to put it. Perhaps I ought to say what I would like to say, I don't know, kind of Menshevik accent. I knew exactly what she meant. Well, of course, it meant the intelligentsia accent, not a broad peasant. That's all that meant. The nearest you could get to it. Intelligentsia wasn't a word for her. She was a peasant girl from my journey. But she must have met some Mensheviks in her life, or at least heard people talk like this. Yeah. Quite funny, I thought, my Menshevik accent.
Now, and later on, people like Nabokov...
Nabokov. Oh, that's later. Nabokov, I met in New York, in Washington during the war. Yes, towards the 1943 or something. 43. He was teaching all kinds of literature, philosophy, and the kind of mixed stuff in a place called Funny, New York, not Funny, American college, of, so to speak, liberal arts college called St. John's Annapolis, which had eccentric principles. Never mind what that was. I would bore you if I told you. And he was there. And I was invited to meet him by some lady in Washington who knew he was a Russian, knew that I was, and thought we would like to talk Russian to each other, which indeed took place. We became great friends quite early. Yes, yes. On the spot. I thought he was the most attractive man. Then we used to go and dine with Charles Bolin, who in the State Department talked quite good Russian, and was a friend of Nabokov. Then Nabokov later became went to Berlin and into the American intelligence and all that. Oh, you see, I met during the war. I met other Russians during the war. I met the Polish wife of the American diplomat. What is his name? Krzysztof Kondra, her cousin, came to see me about 6 months ago, a journalist called Ted Schultz, who works in New York Times. Now, his cousin, she was a sculptress from Poland. But like all Polish Jews of a certain age, talk Russian. Well, that's what all Jews talked in the Russian Empire. He was called Wiley. And he was a straight American, a very reaction American diplomat. She was called Irena. She was a sculptress. So she had a kind of Russian salon to which occasionally I went. In Russian.
In America there was more...
Much more. Far more. Far more. Well, it was a Russian newspaper in America. Daily paper. Which couldn't have existed in London.
And you said that it's a matter of numbers and not that... it's just that there were much less emigres, Russian emigres in...
But no, I think it's just a fact. They went to Paris, went to Berlin. And there were not many in Italy and not many in England. Some. There were a few Russian. I mean, there was no doubt Russian noblemen came here, Russian aristocrats. I used to go to parties given by the parents. Well, I had a friend called Ridley. His mother was the daughter of the last Tsarist ambassador to the court of St. James, Count Benkendorf, who became a Catholic, stayed in England, was buried in Westminster Cathedral. His daughter, Natalie, was married to a man of good family called Ridley, son of Lord Ridley, and his son was here at Balliol. When I was a young don, he was undergraduate. I made great friends with him, and he was killed in the war, and I dedicated a book to him. Now, his mother was pure Russian. Father was English. They used to give parties in London, to which I used to be invited. Her friends were Russian aristocracy. His friends were English men of good family. They didn't mingle. No. The Russians stood on one side of the room, the other, I mean, did a bit. But broadly, you could see which was which. And the Russian took Russian to each other, and the English talked English. And he stood with his arm on the mantelpiece, looking with displeasure on all these awful Russians on the other side of the room. Oh, they talked to each other. What? The following years, middle 30s. So I saw them. I saw somebody called Vorontsov Dashkov. I saw somebody called, Meredith Budberg, the notorious one. She would be there. They only met her after the war. What kind of names they have? Shuvalov.
You have now...
Leaven, all these names, yes. I didn't talk to them. They were white Russians. I was brought up by my parents to regard them as all terrible anti-Semitic reactionaries. They were, by that time, I don't know what they were, but anyhow, I didn't feel anything in common with them. For these purposes, I was a Russian Jew.
Now, Russian aristocratic names crop up in the third generation, let's say Tolstoy or Ignatieff.
Oh, yes. Of course. But they don't talk, Ignatieff doesn't talk Russian. His mother is Canadian. His father was my pupil, actually.
His father was your pupil?
He's a Canadian Red Scholar. He came to Oxford, the son of the last Minister of Education of the Tsarist regime, came to Oxford as a Canadian Rhodes Scholar. Was told by me, great veterans, I took Russian to him. That was either just before or just after the war. I think just before. Not sure, maybe just after. George Ignatieff, this man's called Michael, the son. Well, yes. But I mean, there was a man called, for example, Zinoviev, who was a Russian of good family, because Zinoviev had a very good family. The Bolshevik Zinoviev wasn't his real name, of course. Him I met after the war. After the war, I took an interest in Russian affairs. But all these Willitses and Shukmans and so on, Shukman learned Russian, presumably, in his university, where was it? He wasn't at Oxford.
No, he studied in London.
No, he studied in another university. Somewhere like Nottingham. Somewhere in the provincial university. Not London, no. I don't know where Willits was. Where did he learn Russian? Max Hayward learned Russian in Deeds. There may have been people who taught this thing. For example, Belov's father-in-law, who was in Arkos, and didn't go back. You know what Arkos was, the Russian trade mission. He was one of the people who didn't go back. He became professor of Russian of some sort in Manchester, which is where Belov must have met his daughter. There were these isolated posts for lecturers and so on. London had Sir Bernard Bears, who was a famous Russian historian. Where did Seton Watson learn Russian? I don't know. Not an Oxford, I don't think.
Now, let's move to Aline and her Russian connections, so-called. Now, she's Ginsburg.
Sure.
Ginsburg is a Russian family.
Entirely.
How did Aline feel? Before she met you, and did she have any sense or feeling that she was connected?
Absolutely. Her father was 100% Russian.
Her father?
100%. Her father was called Baron Ginsburg, one of the 13 children of the Baron Gorazio Horace Ginsburg, the famous one.
The famous one from Petersburg.
Yes, exactly. And he had lots of children. Her father left Petersburg, I think, in 1898. Then went to work for the Warburg Bank in Hamburg. Mm-hmm. But these were sort of grand Jewish families, were all interconnected, intermarried too. There were Ginsburgs married to Warburgs. You see? They were never married to Rothschild, so everybody thought they were. She was always being taken, my wife. That's a mistake. She was the first cousin of the Baron Guy, who's the head of the family, but through the mother. Now, he was a straight, well-born Russian Jew. And he supported Ort, which was a typical organization to make Russians economically productive, rather than just be commercial agents. Very good. He came to Paris. He knew white Russians in Paris, some who he supported financially. Russians, not Jews. Jews and Russians. But he was very much a member of the white Russian colony in Paris. Before the war, before the First World War, and after, he was. He refused to become a French citizen.
He
remained a Russian citizen, and after that, stateless. And continued to be so until the war.
Because of nationalism?
Yes, yes. And his little children, little sons, I'm sure, went about in little, in 1914, put on little Russian military costumes. That kind of thing. He was a real Russian. Of course, he was a Jew. His father had a Seder, the Baron. But so, he knew that, of course. He didn't like anti-Semites. But broadly speaking, people he knew were kind of right-wing liberal Russians. The sort of Kerensky-eyed Russians. Maklakov, people like that. And, I mean, musicians, singers, he played the violin himself. His wife had nothing to do with it. I mean, Ali's mother.
An old Jewish French family.
From Alsace. Not very old. Her father was called Deutsch. Or in French, France, it was Dutch. Dutch in French. You call it, you and I call it Deutsch. Dutch. He was called Dutch de la Meurthe. Meurthe is a river. His father came to Paris from Alsace at the time of the Franco-Prussian War because he was such a French patriot. And his son, I don't know what the grandfather was, but it was an Alsatian Jewish family. Like all these Alsatians, the main body of French Jews came from Alsace. With all its French and German names. All these, rabbis and everybody, they all came from there, yes. And so on, all these Gottliebs
The majority, anyway.
Certainly. No, some came from Bordeaux, and some came from Provence. Bordeaux. She only had relations in Bordeaux. But the grandfather, her great-grandfather, came to Paris and had money of his own. What did his son became the Rockefeller agent in Paris and became multimillionaire and had huge shareholding in Royal Dutch, which he sold out in the end.
That's Aline's grandfather on the mother's side.
And he gave money to the Sorbonne, or the street called Rue Deutsche Dormert, which I think has now been divided or even suppressed, I'm not sure. There was a little street called after him. And he was a typical French Jew who hated leaving France, never went abroad if you could help it. Thought that, he used to shoot, at a shoot to which he invited eminent persons, was rich and quite well established, straight Frenchman who happened to be a Jew. There's no question. No members of his direct family were baptized, but certainly people who married his cousins and so on all became, was quite easily, quite often baptized. Now, we have four daughters. One daughter married Pierre de Ginsburg, that's my father-in-law, was always called Pierre, daughter officially of Pierre, thought he was known even in Russia.
He was in Russian Pierre or Piotr?
Well, his official name is Piotr, but he was known as Pierre.
Even by his Russian
friends? By his Russians. Then he had a brother who... That's one daughter. Second daughter married a man called Goldschmidt, who changed his name to Golde. in the First World War because people were persecuted having German names. I was also quite a rich man, whatever he did. The third daughter married a man called Ezra from Bombay in Calcutta, who changed his name to Esmond.
Esmond.
He was a... Yes. He was a rich Indian Jew, perfectly Jewish. His entire family was baptized, all his children baptized. And he had a brother who had a zoo in England. And he was a brother-in-law of Philip Sassoon. And that was the third daughter. And they were very snobbish and very grand. And when he changed his name to Esmond, King Edward VII met him in some club and said, you've changed your name. Ezra is a perfectly good Jew, good biblical name. Can't think why you did that. And walked on.
Who said it?
King Edward VII. But he would mingle to the British aristocracy up to a point. He played polo. And so, that kind of thing in 1900. That's his third daughter. The fourth daughter married to Ginsburg again. Was a cousin. Cousin of...
Cousin of Pierre.
And they all had children. Whom I could describe to. I think I could describe them better. But they all became more or less galley-sized. And then there were my father-in-law's brothers. I only met my father-in-law once.
That's why
in my life.
You know the stories from Aline?
Yes.
From her mother?
He came to see me in Oxford. Once. When he came to Oxford to see his daughter, she brought him to see me. Just as a friend. And to talk Russian.
In the mid-50s?
No, earlier. And he was dead by the mid-50s. About 1946. He died in 47. You see?
And you spoke,
certainly, I had a very good time. He looked exactly like Marshal Pétain. He didn't look like a Jew in any degree. Not at all. Her mother was called an Israelite Française. That meant typical sort of genuinely assimilated French Jews. Well, then you know.
And you spoke Russian?
He was Persian. He enjoyed it.
He
didn't talk Russian that often. He loved England. He hated living in France. He lived in France all his life. He married a French woman, all that. But he loved England, as all Russian Jews loved. My father did, for the same reason. Great liberal country.
But now, did Aline have any memoirs of a sort of Russian heritage? Or?
Well, she knew she was. She knew who her father was. She remembers Russians coming to the house. Friends of her father, of course. Friends of her father's. Of course. No, friends of her father's came. They all talk French, naturally, in Paris. She knew her father was a Russian. And she knew that he had these Russian friends. That's all it came to.
Now, how far did they lead Jewish life?
Well, not entirely not. On Yom Kippur, she went to synagogue. She was given breakfast, but she was disgusted when she discovered that they had to fast. She was very, very, she was deeply disgusted at the fact she was given eggs and bacon, probably, on the morning of Yom Kippur. Once they went to the Rue de la Victoire, no, I think it was Rue de la Victoire synagogue, or maybe it was the Rue Copernic, again, which they went to. But once, I think so, they went once a year. I think nothing else happened. They knew they were Jews, and the brother, the two brothers, I don't know if they did the bar mitzvah, I doubt it. But they knew they were Jews, in the full sense.
Now, would her father be aware of his father's activities in Jewish cultural life?
Oh, certainly. Certainly. Yes. He wasn't very interested, but of course he knew. And his brother was the man who created the famous those scholarships which Shazar had.
So it was his
brother.
It was the father,
wasn't Uncle to Aline.
Uncle to Aline,
yes.
Not the grandfather?
No. Grandfather had nothing to do with it. The Aline's uncle was called David. David Ginsburg was Aline's uncle.
Yes.
direct uncle.
Who lived in Petrograd.
Absolutely. And he knew 40 Oriental languages.
Yeah, that's, I see.
That is the man.
It's, I mean, his collection of Jewish manuscripts.
Of course.
So
of course.
David. Not the grandfather.
No, no. Uh-huh. Grandfather's kind of Jewish mecenas, I mean, benefactor, and yeah. If you had to have a delegation to go and see the Tsar, he headed it. He was number one Russian Jew.
Yes, sir.
But he didn't be taken. He knew Turgenev, he knew John Shorov, knew Russian, had a house in Paris and so on. But...
Now, the uncle that we was saved...
he died before the war.
Before the war.
Died about 1912 or 13.
Now, did Sam Ginsburg remain in Russia? After
one was... Russian? Well, none. One was killed in the Russian army in the Caucasus. Nobody knows how. He was a man who supported Diaghilev, went to fight for the Russian ballet and traveled with him. The rest got out. Those who survived, brothers and sisters. One went to Holland, one, Tube went to Paris. Ali knew them all.
And there were
one,
many. There were
the sister, his sisters, one went to Geneva, one went to Israel.
One went to Israel.
Absolutely. That was the wife of Hillel Zlatopolsky. Hillel Zlatopolsky, yes.
She was a
Jew. Yes. Don't know whether she was his wife, his second wife, I think, yes. Certainly. And remained in Israel. Forgotten what she was called. The one living in Haifa, that was the wife of a man called Ignacio Bauer, who was the chief Jew of Spain.
Ignacio Bauer.
Madame Boer, as they called her in France, Olga Boer, died in Haifa. I didn't quite know why, but she immigrated to Israel.
I
see. Certainly there was a, I'll tell you, much something about Fania, there was a, wait a bit, no, that's something else again. They're not related. There was a man called Proper, who was the Spanish ambassador in Morocco, in Norway. His father was a Jew from Poland or Czechoslovakia. Jewish name. Normal Jew, yes. Baptized, married a Spaniard, and his son was a Franco diplomat.
And he was married to...
He was married to one of the daughters of, what's his name, I'll tell you in a moment. No. Fuld.
Oh, yes.
Fuld is a French Jewish family. Baron Fuld. He was a minister of finance for the Napoleon III. But they were baptized.
Now, Natalia Ginsburg has nothing to do with it.
Fuld Springer, they were called. Fuld Springer.
Fuld?
The man called Fuld married the daughter of the richest Jew in Vienna, who was called Baron Springer.
Ah, Springer.
Who was richer than the rest of us. Vast landowner in Austria-Hungary.
Pardon?
Vast landowner. One daughter married Elise Rothschild. I can go on like that. But it's,
yeah,
has no bearing on my life.
Not at all. No. I see. Well, we have to finish.
Right. Not my world.
No, I know it's not. No, I mean, we started it because of the Russian.
I always read. I read Russian books steadily. And I bought them from Russian booksellers in London. There was a Russian bookshop. There was a Russian bookshop in Paris, to which I went in the 30s, called Povolotsky. There was a Russian book department in Blackwoods. That I did.
Yes, it's fantastic, I must say. Yes.
But it's entirely private. There's nobody I could talk to about that much.
Your parents, did they want you to speak Russian or did they want to...
No, I could talk Russian to them if I wanted to. Not normal.
That's the interesting thing.
Not normal.
And from your childhood.
Exactly. Well, they talk Russian to me as a little boy, of course. Nothing else they could.
Yes, well, that's true.
But not in England. They normally talked English to themselves and to each other and to other people. Of course, when these Russian Jews came, they took Russian. And I understood it. And I talked to them, but only very casually. Though it wasn't continuous in any way.
And yet you say that that's the language you feel at home.
Russian,
more,
yes.
More than German and French. You would.
Well, absolutely. I talk Russian, absolutely. I'm bilingual. I'm literally bilingual. French I don't know, French and German well. I really don't. Less well than people think I do. I read German with difficulty.
Yes, you always claim it, yes.
It's true. I wouldn't claim it if it wasn't true. I have no motive, except the truth.
Yes.
Hebrew I didn't read at all, I mean. Word by word.
But can you communicate easier in German or with German colleagues or with French colleagues?
With Germans.
Now, because of the command
because
of the language,
because of Riga.
Is it something?
Because something of Riga. That I once, until the age of 3, I heard German spoken. My parents are bilingual. They spoke German perfectly. And when Germans appeared, with them not very often, they could, so on, you see. Somehow, I felt I understood German better.
Yeah. I mean,
my mother sang German songs, I mean, we had nearly, on the whole, my whole cultural direction was east of the Rhine, not west.
You know that I have the feeling, and we'll come back to it, not today, that you have some barriers or inhibitions with your attitude toward French.
That's what Aline thinks.
And I think so too.
I don't like it very much.
And I
only have one reason. I have nothing against France or the French. I don't understand the word they say. When they speak, I cannot understand them.
That's the reason.
I read, yes, that is the reason.
Because, you see, I asked you the question. I think it was...
Culturally also, I must say, yes. There is a certain kind of dryness and a kind of lack of any kind of romantic sensibility in the French, which makes them somewhat alien to me.
And
the same is true of Italians. I like them very much, but culturally, I don't feel close to them.
I see.
I have Italian friends, I mean, when I talk to Mobiliano or Franco Venturi.
Yes, no.
Different culture.
I think it's different than that. You see, Aline, having her roots in France, going to Paris quite often, you don't go to...
No.
You don't go to Paris.
Exactly.
You go and have...
I can't talk to them. I can't talk to them. It's a great source of anguish, Charlene.
I think, absolutely. You were not well, so we decided that I'd come back to
great Italy. Source of
anguish. She said, I can talk to you about
it. Indeed, she can.
And she was surprised that I noticed it.
Quite so.
And
it's quite true. And the point is that our French friends are, I mean, I cannot communicate with them in French properly. It really is lack of knowledge of French. Idleness, but not learning it enough. I can read it. But I can't write it and I can't talk it.
And that you think is the main
barrier? Well, it's a barrier, because the French only talk French. Because the English, and it's no living in England, not knowing English. Partly that, and partly therefore, perhaps, I feel that France, Italy, Latin countries are further away from me, funnily enough, than German countries. I think I'd find more in common with the Danes than I would with the Italians.
I think we'll have to come back to it, because it is interesting, I must say. And it's interesting that you feel easier in German because of your Riga days.
Because I understand it better. When people talk German.
You really think
I understand it better.
You understand?
Yes. Well, people think German, it's quite right, I don't really understand. But I know roughly what happens. And I rather enjoy talking about bad German.